I want to thank Rabbi Levy for kicking off. Well, we had a pre-Rosh Hashanah kickoff with Dr. Malamud, but for beginning really what we hope will be a more Sunday morning program throughout the year. We're going to start with, of course, this two-part series, and it's a pleasure to have him in Toronto. With the principal of Ohana, who I understand is invigorating and bringing in new ideas into the school and into our city. So a pleasure to have you,
you
on a professional and on a personal level.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for allowing me to speak. It's a two-part series. So we have this week and next week. And the topic is, what did I say it was? Earthly and heavenly love. And the idea is, earthy. If you got the, I said, Rabbi Kelvin sent out the first one, I said, earthy and heavenly love. And I said, Rabbi Kelvin, they're going to throw me out of this town sooner or later. But I appreciate it if it was a little later. If we start out with earthy and heavenly love, so I'm in trouble. So the real question, it's an analysis of the focus of Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, which I guess embodies the idea of heavenly love for sure, and the question is, does it also embody earthly love as well? And it goes to the question, which is exactly how do we understand metaphor or mashal? I'm not sure metaphor is always necessarily a good translation for the word mashal, but how do we deal with the idea of mashal in the Torah, especially when it speaks about things which are sometimes quite audacious? So what we'll start with in this session, let me work backwards. In the second session, we're going to focus specifically on Shir HaShirim, working through the text, and trying to understand, using our understanding of poetry and of Mashal, that we're hopefully going to develop a little bit this week, try to understand the text of Shir HaShirim, at least in part, a little bit better. It's good morning. So it's obviously not something that you could pack into a day or two, or not even a semester or two, but at least it's a good start. But for the first step, the question is, how do we, as learners of Bible, how do we approach mashal, or metaphor, in Tanakh? Good morning. Are there more handouts over there also?
Here.
Oh, okay, good. So I just, I don't want you to get scared. The handouts have a great deal of text on them. We will not be learning all of this text, but I thought you might like to have the whole text just for your own personal sake. It's hard to come by. This way it's available for you. Also, I'd like to cite as fully as possible, even though I'll only be doing, maybe a fifth of what's actually on this page.
Does that mean homework?
No. No, I'm on break. it's really nice, actually, because when you teach adults, you don't have to yell at anybody when they come too late. If they fall asleep on their svarim, you could just say goodnight. It's been nice. Whatever they get is fine, In high school, you have to go through the whole authority thing, which really I'd rather, on any given day, I'd rather do without. Don't tell anybody that, though, because what you're looking at the top is an introduction of Ebn Ezra's introduction to Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, where he lays out his modus operandi for interpreting and commenting on the Song of Songs. There's a bulletin board, electronic bulletin board called the Lookstein bulletin board, where educators communicate with each other and ask various questions, called LookJed board. Somebody asked on the LookJed board just a few weeks ago, what is the best way to introduce to students the approaches of various commentators? How do I teach them how Rashi goes about his business, how Ebn Ezra goes about his business, how Ramban goes about his business? And what I responded, and what I feel to be very true, is look very often or always somewhere in the text of the commentator will be their call to war, their modus operandi, their raison d'etre, their approach to Tanakh. And it's, to my mind, best to let the commentators speak for themselves instead of trying to figure out, although it's also important, sometimes the commentators change their minds, so it's always important to reverse engineer, to look at how they commented on Bereishit Shemot and then to work backwards towards what their intention was in their commentary. But I think the best place to start is actually with where they state what their intention of the commentary is. So introductions are wonderful things. Rashi only has one introduction, and it's on Shir HaShirim, which we may do a little bit later. And Ibn Ezra has an introduction to every single book, because that was his type of person, and he has an introduction to Shir HaShirim. So he'll give us a good view of how he views the book as a whole, which hopefully will give us a sense of the book, if we buy what Ibn Ezra has to say, which we might or we might not. So, reading from the top of the page, Ibn Ezra says a little introduction, which won't interest that much, but I'll start by reading the entire first section. Zeh HaSefer, this book, meaning Shir HaShirim, Nechbad, it is of great honor, V'chulo Machamadim, and it is all beauteous, it is all quite lovely. That's, by the way, a quote from Shir HaShirim, so he's quoting from the book itself. V'eim b'chol Shirei Shlomo HaMelech Chamisha V'elef Kamohu, and there are none of the 1,500 works of Shlomo anything like it. The 1,500 works, the references in Sefer Melachim, in the Book of Kings, where it states how many books that he wrote, and it says that he wrote, if I'm not mistaken, 1,500 mashal, and that's where he's getting the number from. Al-Kain Katuv Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shlomo, and that's why it says the Song of Songs. And what Ibn Ezra is doing here, because he's a grammarian, is he's saying Shir HaShirim, the format noun, ha-noun, is superlative in Hebrew. That's how you say superlative. An example would be Kodesh HaKodashim does not simply mean the Holy of Holies, it means the holiest of all the holies. Melech HaMelachim does not just mean the King of Kings, it means the greatest of kings. So essentially the format, grammatically, Shir HaShirim simply means it is the song, the greatest song. It's just the way you do superlatives because there's no est. There's no est in Hebrew. There's no EST, like big est or happiest. Kizah shir mu'ule mikol ha-shirim. It is loftier or greater than all other songs. Asher l'shlomo, which he wrote. Uvo sod satum v'chatum. And inside it is a secret which is sealed. Kihel mimei Avraham avinu ad yimot ha-mashiach. Which begins from Abraham until the times of the Messiah. Now, by the way, what's really interesting here is he agrees then with Rashi and with an older Targum, which we will be dealing with next week, that the book is a metaphor for the historical experience of the Jews, of the Israelite nation, which Rashi also has. We only have to open up an art scroll, because they translated it according to Rashi, and we'll be dealing with that later. But Rashi wasn't the first one either. It was the Targum, the Aramaic Targum, written probably about the year 350, maybe 450, which essentially retranslated the text towards a historical meaning. Perhaps meta-historical. It's not just a question of what the Jews did, but the interaction between Jews and God. But he agrees. But what's interesting, he disagrees with Rashi. Rashi says it starts from Moshe Rabbeinu. If you take a look in the R scroll, you'll see that quite clearly. If you look at Rashi, of course, you'll see it clearly. But Ibn Ezra disagrees. He thinks it starts from Dora Mabel, which is why it's always interesting to keep in mind that there's more than one opinion on any given thing. He uses as a template, we're at the end of the second line, the Shira, which this is a Shir HaZinu, which he says also a Chel Midor HaFlaga, which starts from the generations of the Tower of Babel, Ad Shuv Yisrael Mihigalot, Mehagalut, Achar Milchemet Gog Umagog, which goes on to Messianic times. So he says essentially, which is an interesting idea, because he's saying more than meets the eye, he's saying if you want to know what the template is for Shir HaShirim, so look in HaZinu, and that's the template for Shir HaShirim. Ve'al titma. Now this is the exciting part. This is the part that's going to interest us, because now he's going to deal with metaphor. And specifically metaphor which is, I don't want to say salacious, that's not the right word, sensual, I think is the right word. Ve'al titma. Do not be amazed, the Ibn Ezra tells us, third line down in the middle. Vavur shehim shil Knesset Yisrael l'chala. Do not be amazed that essentially the mashal, the reference for, that is, Bnei Yisrael is the reference, the metaphor is a bride. V'hamakom doda. And that it metaphorizes God as her lover. As her lover. Kichein derech hanavim. That's not new here. That shouldn't shock anybody in Shir HaShirim. That's a well-known, well-established principle. And now he's going to give various examples. And as we read through Ibn Ezra, his various examples that he cites, what he's trying to show here is don't be shocked that we're talking about a book of sensuality. And obviously, there's an argument here. He's being argumentative because obviously the very fact that he has to say don't be amazed that Shir HaShirim would speak in terms of sensuality means obviously people were saying that Shir HaShirim was, I mean, probably what people say today, the world hasn't changed, which means probably you had a great many people that when they read Shir HaShirim they probably came up to what conclusion? Well, so that's a love story. It's a love story, and quite a provocative one. Where's God in the love story? It's not a mashal. It's a read it as it is, which is always the danger with a mashal. How do you know whether there's something hidden behind the text? So obviously, it's not only in our times that people read Shir HaShirim as a love story. People in his time read Shir HaShirim as a love story. And not only that, we have testimony from Chazal, but we have testimony even older than Chazal. When I say testimony from Chazal, which we're gonna, it's at the bottom of the page. We'll read that in about 20-30 minutes. So you're talking about the Gemara was put together, Midrashim were put together, and you're quoting rabbis from the year 150 to 250, you're quoting Tanayim. However, the books themselves of Mishalim were written much later. They were written in the time of the Gemara all the way up to the time of Rashi. The latest Mishalim, Midrashim. The latest Midrashim, that is, how to best translate Midrashim, a rabbinic homily on a text in the Bible. A homily. A way of trying to give a sense of the meaning of the text by adding in stories, deeper meanings, hidden secrets, to extract a little oil from the stone, is a midrash. The latest midrashim were written in Rashi's time. The Lech Achtov is a very late midrash, and in fact a lot of people beat up on it because it's really so late and it does a not very good job of taking older midrashim and it tries to collate them together, not always successfully. The oldest extant midrashim that we have, I mean, probably the oldest midrash that we have is the Haggadah, which you can date to about 300 because it quotes the story of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and they're all Yoshvim, they're all sitting around in Bnei Brak and they're discussing what time to read the Shema and they're, that whole thing. So that's probably the oldest midrashic literature that we have, yes. Developed textually at that time. Developed textually. Written down and organized. That is, we assume, and absolutely, we not only assume, but we should assume, that when there's a medrash that quotes Rabbi Akiva, that is that there was an oral tradition of that quote in Rabbi Akiva. However, it wasn't written down until midrashic literature was put together. The same thing with a Gemara. When a Gemara quotes a Braita, we don't have Braitas. We just don't have them. We have Mishnayot, but we don't have Braitas. When a Mishnah quotes a, when a Gemara quotes a Braita, you are hoping that the quote is as accurate as possible, but there was an oral tradition until the year 600 when it was actually put down into text by Ravina and Ravashi. And there's, I don't want to say that it was oral until somebody sat down to write a great big book. There was a series of writings and coalescence and then more writings and more writings. But each one of the midrashim has a certain date stamp to it, and that date stamp was you wouldn't want to call it authorship, but you would want to call it redaction or editing. So I don't mean that midrashim don't go back to the first century of the Common Era. They quote rabbis of the first century of the Common Era, but they weren't edited and written into printed form until the year 600, the year 500, the oldest one being the Haggadah, probably the year 350. The midrashim are very old, but they are not the written form that we have is simply later. The sifri, you're right. The halachic midrashim are older. When did they coalesce into the form that we have? The sifri and the sifra. I would say they're about the same time that the Gemara is coalescing. So you're talking about starting from Rebbe's time, so the year 250 to 275, until the year, but really probably closer to Ravina Ravashi's time, until they take their final form. But maybe I'm wrong, maybe 350, 400, but I don't think that they predate that. The author of the Sifri...
For example, like the Arvavani appears to the Mechilta for the first time.
So what year would you...
The Haggadah got it from the Mechilta.
So you'd say the Mechilta would be...
I'm not sure.
Okay, so if they're midrashic literature, I don't know. It could be, is there midrashic literature that is the form that it has now that actually dates to the Tanaic period? I didn't think so, but I don't know. It's certainly possible. What we do have, though, when it comes to Shir HaShirim is there's testimony that dates back even earlier, because we do have testimony earlier than the rabbinic period, which is the church fathers. Church fathers, the earliest of the church fathers was one of the earliest of the church fathers was a person by the name of Origen. Origen lived in the late about 175 to 250. He wrote the he came up with sort of the definitive version of the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Bible. And when he says, I had very often in his writings, which date back to 150, so you're talking about pre-Rebbe, you're talking about the middle of the Tanaic period, which is astounding. We really don't have any literature directly from that, but we do have Origen's writing, because our writings kept on getting burnt up, and the church's writings did not keep getting burnt up. So there probably was Midrashic literature back. I mean, we have Midrashic literature dated back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's Midrashic literature where Psukim are mentioned, and then there's commentary on that Psukim, but we simply don't have it because it was lost. But we do have the church father literature, and he mentions that he talked to some of his rabbi friends. Now, when Origen says he was talking to some of his rabbi's friends, you talk about Tanaim, which is just incredible. He says, I went to a rabbi and asked him what the interpretation of this verse was. He's talking about, I don't know, Rabbi Akiva, I don't know who he's talking about, but he's talking about Tanaim. It's really quite amazing. And he says that the Jews and we have established that you can't learn Shir HaShirim until you're, I think it was 18, or until you're married. They did not allow people to even look at the book until they had reached a certain maturity age, because people were misusing the book. And in fact, the Gemara comes out with a restriction about singing parts of Shir HaShirim in liquor halls, in bars. Because, well, in that case, it wasn't that the people who were doing it weren't, it wasn't that they were being irreligious, it's that they were extracting a nice verse, it was a pretty verse, and they were using it, and they were singing just that verse, but extracted from the whole, it became potentially salacious or about love stories. So there were a number of strictures protecting Shir HaShirim. So the idea that it's a modern idea that we look at Shir HaShirim, but in the olden days everybody thought it was absolutely okay, is clearly not correct. It's not correct from rabbinic literature, and church literature also supports the idea that Shir HaShirim was a taboo topic until a certain maturity was established. Everybody, feel free to, by the way, again, I, the more questions the better, and if you disagree or if you have want me to clarify, I'm happy to do so. So what he's obviously saying is Al Titma, we're on the third line again in the middle, Al Titma Baburshim Shil Knesset Yisrael Lechala Vamakom Doda Ki Kein Derech HaNeviim. And now we start a laundry list of Neviim that use the idea of Israel as a wife or a bride and God as a lover or a husband. And he gives a series of examples, and what I've done right below the Eben Ezra text is to bring the four examples that Eben Ezra cited. And I think that you'll find that there's a little bit of a problem with those four examples. So let's read the four examples. If you have a Tanakh, it's in Tanakh. But otherwise, I quote it as much as I think is necessary. Sometimes I use an ellipsis. I apologize just to save a little space. The first one is the famous Shirat. What's that? I'm sorry.
I had mine already if the door was too heavy to carry.
I always tell my students, I say, you can't come to class without a Tanakh. I said, it should be like a Bible to you. You should walk everywhere. It usually gets laughs the first or second time, and everybody goes, oh, Rabbi, yeah, the Bible joke again. Ashira na li didi. I sing a song to my friend. Now, li didi is not li dodi. Li didi is li yididi. Yididi means friend. Dodi is more of a more lover. Yididi is more of a friend or a pal. So right away we sense a difference. Eben Ezra is quoting this section. Do you see what I'm saying? On the top I have bold Shirat Dodi the Karmo, but Eben Ezra did not cite the whole text, obviously. So I have the whole text here, or most of the text, on the first paragraph below Eben Ezra's block area. So it's here. I probably should have numbered it. It's here, the first Tanakh area. Ashira Na, this is called the famous Mashal HaKerem, the famous vineyard Mashal. It's something that hopefully every high school student leaves high school knowing, but otherwise, or that is, in yeshivas, they teach this a lot. It's very famous. In fact, it's so famous, there's a B'china Yushalmi, which teaches almost, it's really very common. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry, and of course, it's Yeshayahu. Ashira Na Li Didi Shirat Dodi LeKarmo, the song of my love. That is, I'm going to sing, li didi doesn't really mean two, but it means four. Like when it says li David or li Shlomo, sometimes it means four, sometimes it means by, sometimes it means for the sake of. In Tehillim Ayin Bet, when it says Lishlomo Elohim Mishpatecha Lemelachtein V'tilchacha Lemelach, that could be for the sake of, or as a gift to. So the preposition Lamed to can mean many things depending on the situation. So here it means I am singing for the sake of my love or my friend, because he can't do it for himself, obviously. This is the Navi saying, I'm going to tell you how God feels, because unfortunately God can't come out and write letters across the sky, or at least he doesn't want to. Kerem dodi shirat dodi lecharmo kerem hayal didi bekeren ben shaman. My friend had a, or my love had a vineyard in the corner of Ben Shaman. Where Ben Shaman is not really important. The oily section, it's not really important where it is. Or if there's a deeper meaning, there may be in the various mepharshim try to explain the deeper meaning. But at the very least, it creates a beautiful alliterisms. The poetry, there's alliteration here, and the poetry is quite beautiful. Vayazkehu, vayisalkehu, vayisaklehu, vayitaehu sorek. He took the stones together, he cleaned it up, he made it nice and neat. Vayiven migdal betocho, vayitaehu, and he planted. Vayiven migdal betocho, and he put a nice guard station in the field, that is to make sure it was taken care of. Vigam yekev chatzevbo, he also dug out one of those like a wine press. If you've ever been to Israel, it's like a 2-level stone, and you smush the with your feet in one part, and then there's a little bit of a hole, and it runs into the lower section where the wine is actually collected. Vayikav lasot anavim, and he had hoped to make grapes. Vayas bu'ushim, but all he got were dried up grapes, little things that did not ripen. Now there's an ellipsis, and of course, I'm sorry, I'm not reading the whole thing, it's quite beautiful. Va'ashiteyu, but God gets upset. Va'ashiteyu vata, and I create my, that vineyard, this is the singer singing, this is the dodi singing, not the singer of the dodi. And I left it, batar means desolate. Lo yizamer velo yeader, I did not, yizamer means I didn't prune it. Velo yeader, probably I didn't put a protection around it. Va'ala shamir v'shayit, and the thorns and the shamir v'shayit are probably some kind of thorns and thistles came up. Ve'al he'avim atzaven, I commanded the clouds, mehamtir alam matar, and I commanded the clouds that it shouldn't rain on this vineyard. Kikerem Adonai Tzvaot Beit Yisrael. What am I talking about? The vineyard that I'm speaking about is Israel. It's Beit Yisrael. V'ish Yehuda Netasha Shuav. And the people of Yehuda are its pleasurable plantations. V'yikav l'mishpat v'hinei mispach. And I hoped for justice, and I wound up with, one could only assume mispach is some type of injustice. Litzdakah, I hoped for righteousness, v'hinei tse'akah, and all I get is the yelling, obviously, of the poor and the downtrodden. There's a difference here, though, in this metaphor. That is, in Shir HaShirim, and I guess what I'm asking for, and it's maybe not fair, but I figure most people are reasonably familiar with Shir HaShirim, is something is given away to us in Shirat Karmi, which does not exist in Shir HaShirim. First of all, what's that? The Nimshal is given away. First, and beautifully so. I'm sorry I don't have the whole thing, because I could show you step by step where the Nimshal is uncovered. First, I have no idea who it is. I am singing a song for my love. I have no idea who it is. Sounds like a farmer. I did this, I did that, no success. I said, I'm not going to do anymore. I'm not going to plant anymore. I've had it. Up to that point, you have no idea, except the fact that it's in Sefer Yeshayahu, who the Nimshal is. But in the second line on that page, it says, "Ve'al he'avim atzaveh, I've commanded the clouds, mehamtir alav matar, lest that they, I commanded the clouds not to rain on my field." That's not something that your average farmer could do. Maybe if it's talking to Aboriginal Americans dancing around, they don't do their rain dance, but I don't think that's what's going on. What's happening here beautifully is that the mashal, the metaphor, is slowly fading out, and the nimshal is fading in. And then finally, what do you get in the next line? Now I'm going to tell you what it is. Yes. I'm sorry. Nimshal is it's hard to translate. Reference, I think, is the best. You know, even in poetry, in modern poetry, it's hard to translate. A mashal would be the imaginary representation of what it is that you want to explain. And the nimshal would be the real thing that you want to explain behind the flowery language. And in poetry, what they use now is they call it the reference. So if I say, the easiest way to deal with mashal and nimshal is not actually with a metaphor, but with a simile. The dog barked like screeching tires in the night. I don't know, that's like the worst poetry you've ever heard, but essentially what you get in a simile is you get both sides. You get both the reference as well as the metaphor. In a real metaphor, in a mashal, not only do you not necessarily get what's behind, you don't get the reference or the nimshal, but sometimes there is no real direct correlation. Sometimes the things are quite imaginary, and there's no way to really make a one-to-one relationship between metaphor and that which is being metaphorized. But that's a topic that we'll get into as we progress. Thank you for stopping me. This kind of fade out, and I'm sorry I don't have the quote here, but I think it's safe for me to read you this Tehillim, because it's a famous Tehillim. If you have a Tanakh, if you want to take a look at Tehillim Chaf Dalet, but I assure as soon as I read it, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. And what you'll see is it's actually a common metaphoric methodology, which is to start with a metaphor and slowly fade out into the reference, start with the mashal and slowly fade out into the nimshal. Chaf Gimel, of course, we sing every Shabbat Suda Shlishi. It starts like this. Mizmor le David, David's probably a mizmor by David. Adonai ro'i lo achsar. God is my shepherd, I want for nothing. Now, except for the word God there, you should have one picture, which is sheep. You're a sheep. Vinot deshe yarbi tseimi. Now, forgetting about the name of God, because we don't have the name of God in the second pasuk, he settles me down in pleasant pastures. I'm a sheep. Almei menuchot yinahaleini. And he guides me to pleasant waters. Nafshi yishovev, my soul is, made happy? How would you translate shovev? Made pleasant, what's that?
Content.
Good. Yancheni b'magle tzedek l'man shemo. He rests me in a magle tzedek, in a righteous place, a good place, l'man shemo, for the sake of his name. I'm still a sheep. Gam kielech begates al mavet, even though I walk in the valley of darkness, lo yira ra ki ataim adi. Okay, I'm a thinking sheep, but I'm still a sheep. I mean, it's something that a sheep could feel. Shivtecha umishantecha, your staff and your leaning rod, hema yenachamuni. Yenachamuni, not yancheni of the previous pasuk. The previous pasuk said yancheni, which means he rested me down, which you could do with a sheep. But what does yenachamuni mean? You give me menachamim, you give me comfort. That's not a sheep. You see what I'm saying? That yinachamuni is not that's not a sheep feeling. And it's playing off the word yancheni, which is a sheep. Ani maniach et ha'eder sheli, I put down. But nowhere in the Torah does it ever say that somebody's menachem is eder. It doesn't make sense. So what's happening is the metaphor is sliding out, and what's being superimposed, you have a superimposing, and the reality, the referent, the nimshal, is coming in. And then in the next pasuk it says, Taroch lefanai shulchan, which is obviously not a sheep. It's obviously, now I'm human. Neged sorai, yishanta b'shem rosi, kosi rivaya, achto b'chesi yidufuni kol yimei chaya, v'shati v'eit anai lo rechemin. That is a very, very common method in all biblical metaphor. Not only in Tehillim, but everywhere where metaphor is used, which is all over the place in Tanakh, in every poetic book in Tanakh, where you have a fade-out of the mashal and a fade-in of the nimshal. And what happens is, in that case, is that, so if you're reading Shirat Karmi, how come you know that in the end God is talking about Israel, and Israel is not doing what he wants, and therefore he's taken away all of his protections from Israel, and Shamir v'Shayet will come up, and that'll be, you'll see the destruction that will come up. How come you know such a thing? Because it tells you. What it doesn't tell you, by the way, interestingly enough, is Shamir v'Shayet. Shamir v'Shayet is the only thing in that little mashal. It's not translated. However, later on in Perek Yud Aleph of Yeshayahu, and that's why it pays to be patient with the book, you really have to read through the whole thing, it tells you who Shamir v'Shayet is. It gives you a reference for that metaphor of thorns and thistles. It's the armies of Sancheirif. Says so explicitly in Perek Yud Aleph, if I'm not mistaken, of Yeshayahu, which means as long as you wait, you'll find out who Shamir v'Shayet is. But okay, I don't know what Shamir v'Shayet is. I could just say I could leave that as a metaphor, but I understand the whole metaphor. I understand the meaning behind it. But you can see where the problem is. I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please. That's the whole point.
Okay. When Ibn Ezra starts and he says, don't be so shocked that Shir Shirim is a love story.
Right.
Now I'm going to use some examples that have happened elsewhere. This example, even though there's a mashal and a nimshal, it's not shocking the same way Shir Shirim.
It's not.
So how does that sort of answer his point? I don't think that reference really addresses the issue. Don't be so surprised. We have this all over the place.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with that 100%, which means, but Ibn Ezra is a genius, and he could have selected hundreds of it. I think what he's doing is he's trying to demonstrate first the idea of mashal versus nimshal. He's trying to demonstrate that behind a mashal is a nimshal, because it's not perfect. It has the word dodi, but it doesn't have kala, so it doesn't help us at all. In this case, the Jews aren't metaphor. The Jews is an anachronism, I'm sorry. Although, actually, here it is talking about Shevet Yehuda. So I could say the Jews are metaphorized, but they're not metaphorized as a kala, as a wife. They're metaphorized as a field, as a vineyard, which isn't growing. So as it's terrible in the sense that the metaphor is not the same. It's terrible in the sense that here we have the referent behind the metaphor. But Ibn Ezra knows this. He does know this. So he's starting slowly. That's why I want to show you where each one is. He is building up. He is definitely building up. Why does he start, though, with Shirat Karmi? Perhaps because built into Shirat Karmi is actually a simile, built in. The last pasuk, in the Shirat HaKerem is a little different than most metaphors, where usually the metaphor slides into the reference. But here, it doesn't slide in. It's like, by the way, A equals B and C equals D. Where does it do that? In the last line it says, by the way, Ki Kerem Hashem Tzvaot is Beit Israel. The Kerem I was talking about is Israel. The Ish Yehuda, Nitashu Shuav, and the plantings that I put there are specifically the people of Yehuda. So it's almost like I get a simile after the metaphor. You don't usually get something like that. And I think that Ibn Ezra wants to sort of demonstrate where you could have a whole metaphor, and then the answer is not given by explaining what the metaphor is. It actually, you get the simile at the end. It's sort of like a cryptic key. It's like one of those key things where insert for every Y, insert X, and you can figure out what I was talking about, even though in my opinion the metaphor was fading away because vineyard growers, vintners don't tell the heavens not to rain. But I think there's a polemic going on. The other reason I think what may be going on here is that Shirat Karim was probably as popular back then as it was today. I'll give you an example. I could prove this. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, I can't prove it, but I could argue for it. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, the only book which was found in its totality was Yeshayahu. In its totality, exactly as we have it today, not only in one copy, in two copies. And if you go to, essentially, I don't want to say word for word identical, but very, very close to our text. And if you go to the shrine of the book in the Israel Museum, it's right outside the Israel Museum, the one that looks like a big vanilla Hershey's Kiss. So if you go in there, as you're walking around the area, you have all the little Dead Sea Scrolls, which are really deteriorating fast. And around the kiss, so to speak, on the inside, you have the Megillat Yeshayahu, one of them anyway. There's a Megillah A and there's Megillah B, and actually it's not the original anymore because it was starting to deteriorate. So what they did is they took a photocopy of the whole thing, and now it's a photocopy, and they took the other one and they put it into whatever nitrogen-based however they secure this text. But the fact that the only complete book of Tanakh. They had their own books, which they loved, because they were sort of crazy, to be perfectly honest, and their own ideas that they kept very Kodesh. But art from the Tanakh books, which they also thought were Kodesh, the only ones which completely survived, they have Shir HaShirim there. They do. But what they don't have is they don't have a complete Shir HaShirim. Yeshayahu, however, was such a popular book, that could be another reason why he decided to start with it. But you want to know something? It's not a great argument, and Ibn Ezra knows this, which is why he's probably continuing on. So now, let's take a look at the second one and see how that really stands up towards the light of day. The Ode, Kimsos Chatan Al-Kala. Oh, there's the famous one that everybody knows. So let's take a look. It's the second paragraph of the Tanakh text down here. It starts with the word Leman. Leman Tzion Lo Echeshe. We just read this recently. When did we read this? We read this on... when did we read this? Is this the last of the Shiva Nechamta? When did we read Leman Yisrael Lo Echeshe? It's a Samach Bet. It's Ve'erasti Li Lo Lam Ve'erasti B'tzedek V'chesed Mishpat. When do we read that? That's... Is a Haftorah? It's right before Rosh Hashanah. Is it not Rosh Hashanah? No, it can't be. Is it? Not the first day of Rosh Hashanah. When do we read that? Anybody know? I'm stuck. I know. We just read it within the last 4 weeks. We've read it, but I can't remember. What's that? Nitzavim. Right. So it is. It's the last in the Shiva in the Chamta, or is there one afterwards?
Yeah.
Last of them, right? Yeah, it is very nice. I can understand. Ve'erasti chli lo'olam, ve'erasti v'chesed v'tzedek v'mishpat. Okay. Right. So actually, you can follow along this time if you want, but I have most of the text here. L'man Tzion lo achasheh, for the sake of Zion I shall not be silent. To the man Yerushalayim lo eshkot, and I will not be quiet for the sake of Jerusalem. Ad yetzei kenoga tzidka v'yishuata k'lapid yivar, which is a very, very fancy way of saying until it's the just salvation that it deserves comes out burning like a flame. V'ra'u goyim tzidkech, and all the nations shall see its righteousness. V'chol melachim kvodech, and all the kings will see its honor. V'kora lach shem chadash, I shall give you a new name, or you should be called by a new name. Asher pi Adonai yikovena, that God himself will stamp in. The word lakov means to make a hole, because that's how they used to punch like the names into stone. Think of cuneiform writing, where they actually punch the writings into stone text to give it a certain stability. V'hayit ateret, what's that? It is. It comes from the word hole. It also is a word for a private. It's a word. It's a sexual term for a woman as well. The makor means to create a hole, and in cursing, kov lo makabo lo kavoel. There's a sexual connotation there actually in Bilam, which I don't really have time to get into there. But the idea of a curse meaning I shall put a hole into you, perhaps, so to speak. I shall drive a kind of a rift into you. But the word kov actually means a chiseled hole. V'hayit, in this case, it certainly does not have a negative meaning. It has a positive meaning, yikoven. V'hayit ateret tiferet biyad Adonai, you shall be a crown of glory, of beauteous glory in the hand of God. Utsnif melucha, and a crown of kingship in the hand of your God. Lo ye'amar loch od azuva, they shall not say that you are an abandoned woman. Ula artzech, into your land, lo ye'amar od shimama, they shall not say that your land is desolate. Kilach yikare cheftziba, you will be called the desired one. Ula artzech bi'ula, and your land shall be called that which has a husband. Bi'ula. Although obviously bi'ula has a connotation, a sexual connotation. Ki chafeit Adonai bach v'artzech tibael, because God will want you and your land will be married. Ki yival bachur betula, just like a young man marries a young girl. Ki yival bachur betula yivaluch banayich, that's how your sons will be married. What's that?
More than married.
It is. It connotates a consummation of a marriage. That's correct, absolutely. Umsos chatan al kala yasis alayich Elohayich. And just as a chatan al kala, so too will God celebrate you. In this case, the children specifically, your banayich, will be the women. So here, you can see where Ebenezer is going. Here, the metaphor stands up very nicely. Although it's not a pre-love story, it's a post-marriage story. The idea, even though Be'ulayach has a sense of a sexual or a consummation of marriage, but there's a real marriage going on. But here we can see where Ebenezer is going a little bit better, because here the metaphor matches much more closely what we have. We have a doda and a kala. But on the other hand, I still want to raise the problem. What we also have here, besides the mashal, besides the metaphor, quite clearly is the nimshal. The reference is absolutely clear. When you're reading this, you cannot read, oh, that's just a sexy thing. Yishayahu must have been some kind of depraved guy with watching too much inappropriate television. You know exactly what he's talking about. He tells you, he spells out the metaphor quite clearly. It is impossible to read this book of Yishayahu and feel a real essence of sexuality. The minute that you do it, you try to analyze in your head. Perhaps you could say, why did he use the word yivalucha? Which indicates not only marriage, but a consummation of marriage. So you could start to wonder, is there something in the metaphor which gives something more than marriage? Maybe. But you never lost sight of what it is that Yishayahu wants to get at. So the metaphor is closer to, it's a better proof text from a standpoint, it proves Ebenezer's point that Bnei Yisrael is considered the wife, and God is considered the husband, but it still doesn't really argue to the direct point. So let's try the next one of Ebenezer. Yes, please.
Doesn't that the Shir HaShirim explicitly states the metaphor in these sources. I mean, he's saying that the mashal of a man to a woman is seen elsewhere. And he's doing two different things that are brought elsewhere. But he's not saying that just like in these sources, things are explicit, and in our source, he's not comparing the fact that in Shir HaShirim it's not explicitly stated, and in these sources it is
right.
explicitly stated. He's making the comparison of the
of just the metaphor yeah, of the. Metaphor. He focuses on the metaphor for a few reasons because he can't.
Right. So
there is no.
Why is the source? My question is, what's chaser in
this
source from your perspective?
Well, I'm just saying that he's got a dilemma, which he's going to deal with in the last few lines. His dilemma ultimately can prove one thing, which is that Shir HaShirim isn't a love story.
Exclusively.
That it isn't exclusively a love story, because there's no reference. He can't say, I've got a good example for you in Tanakh, where it's a love story, but it's clear to everybody, even though there's no reference, that it's not just a love story, because he has no text proof for that. So I think what he's doing is sort of throwing various ideas to try to convince you, but we'll see in the last two lines of Ibn Ezra that there's still a problem. He's still worried. He's still very worried, because ultimately, he can't argue that point that I'm arguing, because it doesn't exist. I'm raising the issue, not because Ibn Ezra is, but I'm trying to just point out what Ibn Ezra can't do because he can't do it. I can't go into the mind of Ibn Ezra. Maybe Ibn Ezra was completely happy with his proof text, but I think I'll try to show you that he wasn't. So did I answer your question okay? So I say that you're absolutely right, but there's no way to argue anything but the metaphor reference, because you can't argue for, can I prove that a book of metaphors has two meanings?
I guess my reading is don't be so shocked that Knesset Israel being compared to a Kala, because it's done in other places. It doesn't seem to be saying don't be so shocked that it's not explicitly stated.
He will. Okay. He will. Yeah. He will. It's between the lines, but he will. You'll see. He's quite worried about it. Okay. Yeah.
There's the same argument in Chazal, when they didn't want to
yeah,
have
yeah.
Shirim as part of Kala.
That's the...
I know,
yeah.
And Rabbi Akiva says but it's not based on a... He can't prove it. It's based... Rabbi Akiva just said that's what it means. But
although Rabbi Akiva is so convinced that he says nobody ever had a doubt about it, so maybe Rabbi Akiva sees something that we don't. Now I'll try to demonstrate that in a little bit. You're right. Ultimately, you run into a problem with Shir HaShirim, which is to prove Shir HaShirim has a deeper kind of meaning is impossible, which is explains why, by the way, there's so many interpretations. Mystical, psychological, philosophical, historical, and in the historical, I've got Ibn Ezra starting from Noach, and I've got Rashi and the Targum starting, the Aramaic Targum starting from Moshe, because there is no referent. Now, I think there may be some hints of referent. I'll try to prove to you that later, but ultimately, there's no explicit reference in this book, and it creates a religious problem as well as an interpretive problem. How do I interpret a book that gives me no clues? There are no clues. I do the best I can. Yeah.
Is it important to determine that the author intended it to have a mashal? Or as long as human beings, the rabbis, could impute something that was a mashal to it, isn't that good enough to make it acceptable? And that's why I put it in. Why do we have to care? Was it in the author's mind?
Or you're saying that it was written by... You're saying, it would be acceptable if I could find some kind of holiness in a Led Zeppelin song. Could I then decide if I get enough rabbis behind it that there's a stairway? Could I create a holiness out of a book?
Yeah, in a way, yes. I mean, Led Zeppelin is post-biblical, so we're not going to put it in. But if
I'm not so fast about that. But okay, I mean, it is Led Zeppelin we're talking about. But okay.
They don't need to know what's in Shlomo's mind. Even if they go back in time and say, no, this is really just a love story I wrote, as long as they can make it rich with it, isn't that good enough?
I don't think that that's our take on the books in the canon. I think the books in the canon, Tanakh, there was a sense that they had to be inspired books. The question is, were they inspired by some, whether it was a direct communication with God, such as the Torah, whether it was an indirect communication by God, like perhaps the book in Ketuvim, according to the Rambam, at least the Rambam's view, but somehow there had to be a holy inspiration. There were other holy books of the time. We have wonderful books in the Torah that the Torah mentions. The Torah mentions Sefer Milchamot Hashem in Sefer Bemidbar. It was clearly written by Jews to glorify the wars of God. It probably had all kinds of stuff. Are you familiar with this? This is in Sefer Bemidbar, where the Jews managed to cross the Arnon River, passing through Moabite territory, about to make the last push to Israel. Apparently there was a great miracle, which is only hinted at in the text. Chazal play it up. Apparently what happened was the Arnon River is this massive valley, and all the bad guys were on the north side shooting arrows. It's very hard to cross a valley in war. So apparently the two, are you familiar with this story? The two, they were all hiding in the cave, and God created an earthquake, and all of the Jews were on the mountains of the south, and the caves crashed into the mountain of the south, crashed into the caves of the north, killing all of the Amorites who were hiding there, and the Jews were simply able to skip right over the small divide and go into Eretz Israel. And the Torah talks about this Sefer Milchamot Hashem, which talks about the glories of God, but it's not in the canon. It was simply never included. It certainly was a glorious book. No doubt we could have gotten a lot out of it. It's too bad that it wasn't in the canon, because it was lost over a period of time. There's also another book called Sefer Yashar, which is mentioned in Sefer Yoshua. So Rashi says it's Sefer Bereishit, but that's not the common thinking. There was a book called Sefer Yashar, which no doubt was also a very inspirational book, but it wasn't inspired. So our take is that... That's correct.
That Shlomo was actually a Navi and he really heard the voice of God to tell him to write?
That, I have to say, I'm not going to answer that question. It's actually a fascinating topic. The Rambam sort of is the... Rambam defines three levels of Nevuah. He calls it the direct Nevuah, and then Ruach HaKodesh is the lowest form of Nevuah. He's argued on by the Abarvanel, who doesn't like his whole take, which is amusing, by the way, because Abarvanel is a real Rambam guy. The Radak comes in, he can't really directly support Rambam, but he supports Rambam. You're asking questions: what is the nature of prophecy? How does it work? And what is the nature of inspiration? How does it work? But it's a too large topic for... it's a great topic, by the way. It's a fantastic topic. I love that topic. But it's not something that I to do right now. I'll leave it as undefined, simply saying that I believe that when it comes to the canon, it was never reader centric. It always had to be author centric. How did it get that way? I guess people just felt that it was right, and when people felt it was right, it had a certain... I copied it. I gave it to my son. My son gave it to their son. There's a reason why there are about 10,000 manuscripts of Rashi, but one manuscript of Rashbam, because people just knew that Rashi was, you know, it was a really good interpretation. Not that Rashbam was wrong, but they felt that Rashi was inspired. So Lahavdil, when people read Sefer Yeshayahu, they were like, that's from God. They probably knew Yeshayahu when he was writing his books. How do you know that a prophet's real? I mean, there weren't people who said that Yeshayahu was a false prophet and that Yirmiyahu was a false prophet. I assure you, some people took Yirmiyahu's book and threw it into the fire, which in fact is exactly what happened. Do you remember the story with Yehoyakim? And he writes this book and he throws it into the fire because he's so upset, so he has to write a second version of the book. So how a book actually gets the stamp of I am inspired, it's a good question, but not something I think I could deal with. Yes.
Well, someone gave me a book that talks about the 8 musicians, including some of the Strausses. Unfortunately, Mendelssohn and one of the Strauss, they were Jewish, but they accepted Christianity.
Yes, sure.
This book is called Talks with Famous Musicians, and they have documented with this author. Unfortunately, I lent it to somebody and he lost the book. And there are many artists who feel that
inspired.
It's not their creation. Mm. They were inspired. And whether it be from whatever source it is. I think even Mozart mentioned somewhere.
I'd like to shock you. Could I shock you? And I'm being recorded, so I'm going to say something shocking, but I'm going to shock you. It's a machloket, whether it is an argument, it is a dispute, whether prophecy is dead or not. We tend to think that is based on our rabbinic literature, we believe prophecy died out with the coming of Alexander the Great. The Book of the Maccabees is absolutely clear. Shimon, the Maccabee, takes on the Kahuna Gedola. He decides to take on the head priesthood because he writes, it's explicitly written in the Book of the Maccabees, which was written about 140 BC, before the Common Era, that prophecy is long since gone, and therefore, since there's no prophet to tell us who should be the high priest, I'm doing it. And when a high priest should come along, I'll step down. But until then, I got the job. Which, by the way, caused all of the Essenes who went to live in the dead in Qumran, had them pick up and leave, because they were not amused. There is no Book of the Maccabees among the Dead Sea Scrolls. They would have burnt it if they found it. It was a great dispute, essentially, between the Essenes and the Maccabees. However, the whole idea of Eliyahu HaNavi, and in mystical, I assure you that Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a book called Magid Meisharim, which is without question by him. He believed that prophecy was alive and well. The ecstatic Abu Lafia was an ecstatic Kabbalist. He believed that prophecy was alive and well. And now I'm going to say something shocking. Most Kabbalists feel that Eliyahu, the whole idea of Eliyahu being the live link essentially to prophecy. That's why they all mention the Eliyahu. That's why we mention the Eliyahu. It's the idea that prophecy doesn't die because there's an open channel to God. So the idea that people think that everybody assumes that prophecy is dead is not a given. Is not a given. And I can tell you something. I'm not making any conclusions. And now I'm going to say there's something that's shocking. You ready? Oprah Winfrey gets on TV about a year and a half ago. She's a millionaire many hundreds of times over. And I don't know if you saw this episode where she gets up and she was embarrassed about herself. She wants to catch people who abuse children. And she gets on her, does anybody remember this? She gets on a television show and says, I will give $100,000 to every single person to tell us the whereabouts of a child molester who has disappeared. They're all supposed to register, but a lot of them are disappearing. I will give $100,000. She said, I woke up in the morning and God was speaking to me. And then she got very embarrassed because nobody likes to like say that I'm a prophet. But that's what she said. And I know that's what she felt. She feels that she woke up or she had a dream and God spoke to her and said, take your millions of dollars and give $100,000 to every single person who finds a person who abuses children and make sure they get captured. I fully believe that, I 100% believe that Oprah Winfrey believes that she received prophecy. And I'm not ready to discount the possibility.
Do you see what I'm saying? You say your prayer at night before you go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Then you wake up the next morning and you feel directed to do something.
Right.
You don't hear a voice.
Right.
But that doesn't come from you.
So that's the Rambam's. It's what the Rambam calls. The Rambam said the lowest form of nevuah is an inspiration to do great things for the world.
Okay, I'm going to be the devil's advocate now.
I'm just going to ask you. Do you mind though? I got off the topic of what is prophecy, and again, it's a great thing, but I sort of want to back up to Shir Shirim just because I won't be able to.
How do we know for sure that there is this mishma?
This nimshal
and the mishma.
How do we know there's spirituality behind the book?
That's right.
That's what I'm going to prove right now. Okay. That's what I'm going to show right now. So let's continue on though with his various Ibn Ezra's text proofs. So it says, he quotes finally Yechezkel. Now Yechezkel, that's quite spicy. And in fact, the quote that he quotes is, Shadayim Nachonu, your breasts have become ready, V'sarech Tzimach, and Tzameach, and I think Tzimach, V'at Arom V'erya, which means you have become sexually mature, and yet I find you naked and uncovered. I've quoted the whole thing here, so I can quote it better, which is the third paragraph down. Am I right? Is that the third paragraph down? Yes. Vayi dvar Hashem Eli lemor. God spoke to me. Ben Adam. This is Hashem speaking to Yechezkel. Of Kid. Right. Ben Adam, Hodad Yerushalayim et to'avoteha. Tell, inform, instruct Jerusalem of all her abominations. Revava ketzemach hasadeh, and I skipped a whole bunch. Revava ketzemach hasadeh, nitaticha, vatirbi, vatigdali, vatavoi, ba'adi adayim. I skipped all the nasty stuff, and I went right away to where God is saying that He will save Israel in spite of all of her sins. So tell her that I will bring her, she will come, ba'adi adayim, in great jewelry. Shadayim nachonu usarech, simeach, Va'at erum v'erya. You will be ready in a sexual sense. That is, your breasts will have grown, your hair will have sprouted, and yet, I think there's a negative connotation there, and yet you are still naked and you are exposed. Your sexuality is exposed. Va'avor alayich, and I will pass over you. Va'ereich, and I will see you. V'inei itech et dodim. But look, it's the time of love. The efros knafi alayich, and I will stretch not my wings, but my corner of my garment. I will stretch my talit over you. Va'achase er vateich, and I will cover your nakedness. And I will make a swear to you. And I will come with a covenant with you. Nu'um Hashem Elokim vatihi li, and you will be mine. Va'er chatzech b'mayim, and I shall wash you off with water. Ve'eshtof damayich me'alayich, and I will clean you from your blood. Va'asuchech b'shamen, and I will anoint you with oil. Va'al bishech rikman, I will put, rikma is a type of spice. Va'en alech tachash, and I'll give you, it's hard to say what kind of shoe, some kind of leather shoe. Va'ech b'sheich b'sheish, and I will put a tachbosh, and I will wrap your wounds with a silk. No, sheish is silk. Some type of cloth. Va'achaseich meshi, and I shall put meshi, that's silk, around you, will cover yourself. Va'adeich adi, and I will give you jewelry. Va'etnat smidim al yadayach, v'ravid al gronech, and I shall put bracelets on your arms and a necklace on your neck. This is doing something, in my opinion, that the other Mishalim are not doing. And something that's going on in Shir Shirim, that is, Ebenezer had to use this. First of all, we still have our problem, which is, the problem that we have is, the reference is still here. There's no doubt that, and in the whole text, it's quite clear. Ben Adam hoda yushlaim et toa voteha. We know, what's that? That's correct. He said, following the Pesidim, so we have no doubt whatsoever. We could argue that maybe preceded it because it was, but that gets to the point I wanted to make. There is something different about this sensuality than all the other ones, which is here, we are not in R-rated territory. We're beyond R-rated territory now. We're beyond PG-13, to say the least. Then isn't everything else it was about? Love and marriage. Here we're talking about sexuality. Real, where parts of the body which cannot be understood in any other way except in sexual terms, or Shadayach Nachonu, V'Sarech Tzimeach. The question is, why did God have to use such a, I don't want to say gross metaphor, but such a explicit metaphor? Well, that's something we could ask Yechezkel. That's something we could analyze the book. But there's no question that what Ebenezer gets out of here is he knows that people are going to be saying, fine, love stories I'm okay with, and nice songs I'm okay with, but Shir HaShirim is X-rated. And it is in many parts. I'll show you. It's not just R. It's quite X. If I don't show you this week, then God willing next week. But here too, what we have is essentially X-rated text. We have it's sexually explicit text, and what Ishir and Ebenezer is saying, and that should not bother you, because here we have a proof that nobody has any doubt Yechezkel is a holy man, and that it was referring to only holy things. And here the fact that there is a referent helps Ebenezer. He's trying to say, just because you see sexuality does not mean there's a holy referent behind it. But we still have that problem that we're going to have to deal with. We're going to have to come to terms with. Finally, let's see what else I have. We have... Yes, Hosea. It's already 10 o'clock, and I wanted to have a small break. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip the Hosea text, but the nice line is the one I bolded. Ve'eras tich li lo'olam, ve'eras tich li b'tzedek v'mishpat v'chatz v'rachamim, ve'eras tich li b'emunah v'yada'at et adonai. Of course, the famous line that we say when we put on our tefillin. It's a beautiful, beautiful line which describes the relationship of God and man, God and Israel, as husband and wife. That's very important, but we'll spend some more time on Hosea another time, because it is one of the most explicit texts in the book, and the question is why. And what I'll try to prove to you is that there was a problem of sexuality in the time of Hosea. He used this metaphor specifically because the Asherah goddess had come to light, and the idea of holy prostitution was reinstituted in Israel, and Hosea was dealing with it. So with Hosea, I could actually show you historically why he decided to use these metaphors. With Yechezkel, it's simply for a purist reason, which is that it was a powerful metaphor. I mean, again, there's no real way to mention it. Now, I want to go back to Ibn Ezra and just show you, to answer the question, that Ibn Ezra is still disturbed by the things that I'm talking about, which is as follows. We're going to skip down to the third to last line in the top introduction of Ibn Ezra, that's here where it says, V'chalila, V'chalila. And I'm going to translate Chalila. Today we would say, we would translate Chalila, Chalila as Chas V'Shalom, which we then for translate as heaven forbid. But the word Chalila actually means it is impossible. That's the way Ibn Ezra uses it most of the time. V'chalila, Liyota, Davar, Kain, it is impossible. V'chalila, Chalila, it is utterly impossible. It is inconceivable. There's a famous line, if you don't mind me digressing, it just popped into my head, and I sometimes like to digress myself. I don't know if anybody saw the Princess Bride. I love the movie Princess Bride. And there's this part where he says, it's inconceivable. The person's following us, and he keeps saying it, and it keeps happening. And then the one person says to the leader, he says, inconceivable. I do not think that word means what you think it means. But I think it means exactly what Eben Ezra thinks it means. It is utterly inconceivable, and let's see what is utterly inconceivable. I'm sorry, I sometimes do those little mental asides. I apologize. I don't know how I'd be able to teach without watching movies, to be perfectly honest. V'chalila v'chalila liyot shir ashirim b'divrei cheshe ki'im al derech mashal. It is impossible that the book is about cheshek, which itself, the word l'chashek means to combine together. If you remember, when you're building the Mishkan, there are the chashukim, which combine the two amudim together to keep them tightly connected. That's what the original word means, cheshek. But probably what it means here is desire. If you want, eroticism would not be an unfair term. And I'll prove that, I'll go into that idea next week, because Eben Ezra lived in the time of erotic poetry. And he wrote some himself, although very, very little, but there were other people who wrote erotic poetry at the time. It was the Andalusian period, and the Arabs, before the attack of the fanatic Arabs in Spain, were a very high culture. They came up with algebra, of course, and mathematics, and they wrote very, very provocative poetry, and Eben Ezra was a part of that culture, although he was at the very end of the culture. So we'll see how he uses the word. We'll do some readings for Eben Ezra's poetry, God willing, and you'll see how he uses the word. But if you want to translate Cheshek as a love story, that would be fine also, although it's probably not powerful enough. Ki'im al derech mashal, except by way of metaphor. That is, yeah, it's not about Cheshek, except the Cheshek is being used as a metaphor. Which means, he obviously, the problem still exists. For all of his proofs, he hasn't got rid of that essential problem. How does he prove it, by the way? It's not a great proof. V'lulei godel malato, had it not been great, for the greatness of the book, lo nechtav besod sefer kitvei hakodesh, it never would have been included in the groupings of the canon. So does not mean a secret here. It's like from the bracha of Shimon, or not the bracha / klala, when Yaakov speaks about Shimon and Levi, he says, besodam al tavo nafshi, a sod meaning a group or an organization, amongst their group. Obviously you can see where then the word secret came out of that, because when you have a group of people, they keep secrets. But that's the etymology. The original meaning of the word was not an abstract idea, it was a concrete noun which meant a group of people. So he says, very simple, I got a proof for you. How do I know the book is holy? Because it was included in the canon, which is a circular logic, and goes to your very issue. Although, the argument is not impossible. It's trying to say, the Jews are smart enough to include what deserved to be included. But ultimately, it's circular logic. I include a book of the canon because it's holy, and I know it's holy because it's included in the canon. It's a circular reasoning, which is clearly a problem. So now he's going to, he sees the problem, so he's going to add to it. Not to the problem, he's going to try to solve the problem. You got Eben Ezra, by the way, every word. I mean, he knows, he's a genius. He's a mathematician, a scientist, an astronomer, an astrologer also. His arguments are so carefully laid out. He says so much in so few words, which makes Eben Ezra so difficult to read, but gives you such pleasure when you actually kind of get it. Ve'ein alav machloket, ki hu mitamei et yadayim. And not only, there was never an argument. That is, some books may have had trouble getting into the canon, which may have opened up the door that maybe it wasn't so holy. Not this book. There was never a machloket that it belonged. Mitame yadayim means it impurified the hands. That has to do with mesechei yadayim. It means it's a holy book. All holy books, mitame yadayim, in scroll format. The reason why it's a rabbinic law, we often have issues where women think that they can't touch a sefer Torah, but I'm not sure where that came from. I'm pretty sure it's wrong. Maybe the rabbi could correct me. The idea that based on a woman's status, you can't touch the Sefer Torah. As far as I know, you cannot be metamei a Sefer Torah. In fact, it's the opposite. When you touch a Sefer Torah rabbinically, the Sefer Torah makes you tamei. And that was for a rabbinic reason, because essentially the Sefer Torah was being stored in the same place as food, and the rats started to eat at it. So essentially they were saying you can't touch the Sefer Torah. So it's us who are metamei. We are impurified by a Sefer Torah, but we can touch the Sefer Torah all we want. I'm sorry, go ahead. You want to ask a question? There is. Well, that's the last thing I'm going to do before we take a little break. Yeah. He's saying that, according to Eben Ezra, he's simply saying that Shir HaShirim never has any machloket over whatsoever. I'll tell you something. Now you discover something about Eben Ezra. Eben Ezra likes to argue, and sometimes the facts don't always work out his way, like pretty much any debater. Anytime you get into a debate, you always know that there's some arguments against your point. You just don't like to raise them. So we're going to see that, and Eben Ezra knows very well the arguments against his point, but he's being polemical here. He's arguing. He has to, that's, The fact that Ibn Ezra is lying, and I don't want to say he's lying, but he's going to ignore certain facts that don't fit with his theory, means he's worried. He is worried. He realizes his arguments are circular. And therefore, he's going to cite a fact that fits his reasoning, because he's hoping people will read him and believe him, rather than going back to the Makor Medrash and see that there was, in fact, Machloket. But we'll see. Maybe there was a Machloket, maybe there wasn't. Let's see what Ibn Ezra was. We're going to read that. We're going to do that in about 2 minutes. But I want, that's how worried Ibn Ezra is. And then you could decide whether Ibn Ezra is being honest or not. I gave it away by saying I don't think Ibn Ezra is being honest. But you'll sometimes find that Ibn Ezra, he does that. When he talks about sight, he says, sight, in one of his parshanim on sight, he says, sight is the greatest of things because you can see far. And then he has another thing about Hazinu Hashemayim Vadaber, and he says, hearing is the highest of the... he argues what he wants to argue. He has points to make, and he'll go ahead and make them. The Lioto Bedarch... Oh. V'liyoto bidrachav tamim, and now he's starting to rhyme, so you know Ibn Ezra is having fun. In order to be pure, that is, bidrachav tamim, in order to be honest to the book, pirashtiv shlosha pamim, I am giving you three separate interpretations. Bepam rishona, the first interpretation, agaleh kol milatzvuna, I will give you all hidden words, all obscure words. I'm simply a translation system. I'm going to give you the simple pshat, which means I'm going to treat not the metaphor, I'm going to treat the metaphor as if it's the text, which means I'm going to tell you all about the love story. And we're going to talk about when if you take a look at the art scroll where it says that there never was anybody who ever translated as a love story, you'll find that that's not being very honest whatsoever, because Ibn Ezra absolutely does, and we'll find that Rashi does a little bit also. I will translate it based on the midrashic or the homiletic interpretation. Let's see, what time am I supposed to go to, by the way? 11?
11.
So I'm going to stop. It's going to take about 3 minutes to read this, and then we'll have a little break, and then we'll pick up with some readings from Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim v'Kohelet Metamet Yadayim. This is a midrash from Masechet Yadayim. Shir HaShirim and Kohelet, according to this opinion, the first opinion of tonight, is both of those are holy books. Rabbi Yehuda says Shir HaShirim Metamei Yadayim. Rabbi Yehuda does agree that Shir HaShirim is Metamei Yadayim, is a holy book. The Kohelet Machloket, but he says that he's not saying that Kohelet is not a holy book. He's just saying that there was a dispute about Kohelet. Rav Yossi Omer says Kohelet Eino Metamei Yadayim, the Shir HaShirim Machloket. You got to ramp it down a little bit. He's saying there's no way that Kohelet is a holy book, but Shir HaShirim, I will admit that there was a dispute over it. Which means some rabbis, according to the first opinion, both books, there was never any dispute. According to the second opinion, there was never a dispute about Shir HaShirim, but Kohelet, there was a dispute. According to the third opinion, there was a dispute about Shir HaShirim. There were some rabbis that definitely said it was always holy, but there were others who are not so sure. Rav Shimon Omer Kohelet Mikulei, I'm going to skip that line. And go to, Amar Rav Shimon Barazai, which is towards the end of the second line down. Rav Shimon Barazai says, "Mekubal ani mipi shivim mishnayim zkenim." I heard this from 72 elders. B'yom shehoshivot at Rav Elazar ben Azariah b'yeshiva, on the very day that they made him the head of the yeshiva. Shashir Ashirim Mekolat Matamid Yadayim. I'm telling you, there was no dispute whatsoever. The opinion of Rav Yossi that there was a dispute about Shir Ashirim, wrong, simply incorrect. We'll see. More, he may be referring to Rabbi Akiva. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Chas v'Shalom, God for heaven forbid. Lo nechlak Adam Yisrael. There was never ever dispute. Al Shir HaShirim, Shalom Atame Yatiyayim. It's a double negative. What it's saying is that everybody, it was never, Rabbi Akiva is telling you, forget what Rabbi Yossi said. It's wrong. We got 72 people. There's no doubt Shir HaShirim has no argument whatsoever. Shalom Titama Yatiyayim. She'ein kol olam kulo kidai ki yom shni. The world is never going to be as worthy as it was on the day that it received Shir HaShirim. The Israel, Shnatan Bo Shir HaShirim, the Israel, Shekolak Tuvim Kodesh, all are holy. V'Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kodashim. So Rabbi Akiva is laying it on thick, to say the least. V'im Nechleku Lo Nechlua Kohelet. And if there was an argument about Kohelet, which I'm not sure Rabbi Akiva is so convinced about, then I will at least admit that maybe Kohelet. Up to here, I think it's fair to say that Ibn Ezra is saying exactly what it says. One can certainly ignore Rabbi Yossi's opinion based on the evidence. However, he doesn't quote the end of the Medrash, and most people don't. And by the way, look at the article. The article only quotes up to this line and stops. It does not read the next line, so I will read it for you, because I do not like suppression of truth. Rav Yochanan ben Yoshua ben Chamiv shel Rabbi Akiva. So how is he related? I'm always bad with the whole relation things. He was the brother-in-law?
Ben Chamiv.
He was the son of the father-in-law. He was the son of the father-in-law, right? So it's brother-in-law, right? Okay. So brother-in-law. Rav Yochanan ben Yoshua ben Chamiv shel Rabbi Akiva kedivrei ben Azai kach nechleku. Kach nechleku v'kach gamru. You say we're the paskin like Ben Azai because kach nechleku, they did have a dispute. The kach gamru, they decided that Ben Azai was right, which means that it wasn't that all 72 simply agreed. All 72 decided there was a macholket. Kach nechleku, they had a dispute on Shir HaShirim. The kach gamru, when they came to the conclusion, which means it's not so simple. Rabbi Akiva's assertion is not so simple. There is room for doubt. What it's saying is that it wasn't 70 people all got together and said, no doubt whatsoever. It was simply the majority that came out pro Shir HaShirim to decide that there was never a machloket, which means not so simple. Rabbi Akiva knows the Ibn Ezra knows the Medrash.
In the Gemara, it never explicitly.
You're right, the Gemara doesn't bring this down.
So, but here, it never explicitly says. When they quote Ben Azai, Ben Azai said, "I'm telling you, 70 days we all agree that Shir."
That's correct. You never get Rav Yochanan bar Yeshua in the Gemara. It's only in the Midrash that you get it in the Midrashic
right.
Literature.
No, he just says we follow what it says in Ben Azai, and Ben Azai never quotes that it's not the Tamei Beizayim. Ben Azai says the day they appointed Rav Elazar ben Azariah.
That all 72 people agreed, right?
So it implies there was a machloka.
Okay, you're right. I mean, I'm happy. Believe me, you're saving the Ibn Ezra. I think I'm happy to say that Ibn Ezra was being completely intellectually honest. I'm just not entirely sure. The way it reads to me is that the 72 people had there was some spitting and scratching during that. That's correct. Yeah, but yeah, he quotes in such a way that doesn't permit. And by the way, he's not doing anything. If we want to yell at Ibn Ezra, it's fair to yell at Art Scroll and everybody else. So the reason why you're at what's that?
Not the same thing. Yell at the Art Scroll.
You're saying Ibn Ezra's Kodesh and Art Scroll's Kodesh Kodashim. Okay, so because this is being quoted, I know. I was being facetious, but I was saying because I don't want to get sued and I'm being recorded. So I'll just go with that. Okay. What I'd like to do, I think maybe to shake off a little bit, is let's maybe 7 minutes, if that works up to 25. Is that good for you? What do you think?
It's up to you.
So, if we call five, we'll start about seven, and then we'll do some readings directly from some different places in Nachum. What I'll try to demonstrate is the power of a mashal, and how a mashal without that is. What I'll try to, we'll do some readings from various mashalim, and I'll try to show that the way that the Tanakh use metaphor is sometimes, if you don't pay attention, that there may be some places where the metaphor doesn't include the referent, or if you read the metaphor without knowing that there's a referent behind it, you come up with an incorrect read. So we'll do that in about 5 minutes.